Chapter 11, It's Greek to Me by Willie Snow Etheridge. 11, Only a Small Voice, and Then It Is Finished. We are up, packed, and ready to ride before 8 o'clock the next morning, but the telephone lines are still broken. We gather in the lobby of the hotel and confer. I am optimistic. Surely the lines between two towns as large as Agrinion and Patras will be repaired immediately. But Margaret and Eleni do not understand. Say, I do not understand Greece. It may be weeks before they are repaired. We decide to go directly to the telephone exchange and learn, if possible, the true situation. On the way, strolling, of course, down the middle of the street, we meet, quote-unquote, our doctor, also strolling down the middle of the street. He has come from the telephone exchange and is cheerful. Perhaps by 9 o'clock the lines will be intoxicated. We continue to the exchange and stand about, waiting. Our doctor and I stand together, unable to say a word to each other. He knows no English, and I know in Greek only entaxie and efkiaristo. We watch thin-legged boys walking by. Their coats are too small for them, and their pants are made of patches. One is eating a piece of pink candy. Les enfants vont à l'école, a doctor says. Oui, oui, I cry, and our doctor and I grin delightedly at each other. It isn't a world-shaking communication, of course, to hear that children are going to school, but the fact that our doctor and I have finally communicated directly with each other gives us an absurd amount of pleasure. Finally, there is a torrent of jabbering between Eleni and the telephone operator. Eleni hurries into a booth in one corner of the room. The lines are repaired. We have Athens. Ambros, Eleni shouts. Ambros, bros, bros. She cries so loudly that even if the lines weren't fixed, Laird Archer could surely hear her in Athens. Ambros, Ambros. What in heaven's name is Ambros? I ask Margaret. It means go ahead. I like it. It sounds so emphatic, so direct. I begin to help Eleni shout, Ambros, Ambros, and at last it works. We have Laird on the phone. He agrees to our going ahead, but says we must confer with the chief of police in the last town we pass through before entering Gorilla Hill territory. Costa looks unhappy as we start. Costa has asked the police if the roads are mined, Eleni explains, and they said, no, not yet, as far as they know. If they are now mine, it is our fate. I don't care for the sound of this, but say nothing. As we retrace our way to Antirion, where the ferry landed us the day before, we meet a truck, and Costa gets out and waves it down. Costa stops to inquire about our lives, Eleni comments. I don't care for the sound of this either, but still say nothing. I really can't think of anything to say. But the truck driver can give us no news. He has not come from Delphi, but from Patras by ferry. We start again. The improvised door on my side of the jeep falls off. Costa gets out, picks it up, and stows it in the back of the jeep with Margaret. I feel horribly exposed. They can shoot me so much easier now, I wail. We come to Naupactos, the last town before we reach guerrilla territory. Eleni goes to confer with the chief of police. She returns smiling. It is all right, she advises us. We decide to eat before going further. There's nothing like a full stomach, we agree, to give one courage. We bump around the town looking for a restaurant. The biggest one has closed because there is no longer any traffic through Naupactos. Since the guerrillas have camped on its outskirts, no cars or trucks go that way to Athens. This civil war is the death of Greece, Eleni mourns. No food moves, no clothes, no medicines, nothing. My God, it is terrible. Finally, we find a small restaurant and visit the kitchen to study the food in the big copper pots. I choose lamb with tomato sauce, rich with olive oil and garlic, a wild green that tastes considerably like collards and rice cooked so beautifully that every small grain stands absolutely alone. A little after 1 o'clock, we're off again, and around 2, we're climbing steadily upward into the mountains, away from the sea. We are rather quiet. I am not frightened, but I keep thinking of the English soldier's remark about not wanting to leave his bones in Greece. As we near the crest of a lofty mountain, the jeep sputters and stops. What in the world? We look at Costa. Costa looks at us. My dears, Eleni explains, only a small voice, and then it is finished. Exactly, but we can't believe it. We tumble out laughing. It is impossible, we feel, for a jeep to break down, and especially in the mountain fastness of the gorillas. This simply couldn't happen. In a few minutes, all will be intoxie, and we will again be on our way. Costa lifts the flat hood of the jeep and peers inside. I climb a slight rise on the side of the road and look carefully about. All is peaceful. There is not a gorilla in sight. Far down the mountain, in a narrow valley, a half dozen peasants are plowing a small field. I can hear them calling to one another. The sound of our voices, of their voices, is very pleasant. To the left of them is a shepherd watching his flock of sheep. The bells tinkle lightly and ever so sweetly in the clear, bright air. Costa putters about in the engine of the jeep. Eleni and Margaret watch him. I don't understand many things about an engine, Eleni announces matter-of-factly. Margaret says she used to be able to take her Ford apart and put it together, but a jeep? Only by moonlight we will see antiquity, says Eleni, referring, of course, to Delphi. It is a pity we are three women without boyfriend, but it is so. Costa thinks we should turn the jeep around so it can roll downhill and he perhaps can throw it into gear. We three women begin to push while Costa moves the wheel. The jeep is terribly heavy for such a small vehicle. We heave and grunt and cry, "Embrace," but still we cannot budge it. We straighten our backs and we see practically upon us as rough-looking a bandit as I've ever seen in the illustrations of Treasure Island. He has to be a gorilla. He is tall and wiry and has a pugnacious reddish-blonde mustache. He spits out a few words in Greek. Eleni spits a few back at him. Calmly, he puts his hand on the jeep and begins to push. Immediately, Margaret, Eleni, and I begin to push, too. The jeep moves. In a few moments, it is headed downhill, and the fierce-looking stranger is headed downhill behind it. He has a round black patch on each side of the seat of his pants, making his ding-dong look as if it has eyes. Fascinated, I watch the eyes until they are out of sight around the curve of the mountain. Then I remember Costa and the jeep. I gaze along the road, running just beneath me. The jeep is still stalled. The engine didn't catch once on the long incline. Eleni stands beside me. I beg not to cry now, she mourns. By coincidence, the moonlight in Delphi is finished. I spread my coat and stretch out upon it. Eleni lies down on a pile of small sharp rocks and smokes a cigarette. The sun is as warm as in May, and lying there on top of the mountain, We seem very near it. I can see for miles and miles, far beyond the gnarled feet of our mountain and far beyond the wide-spreading valleys, I spy a village on the sides of two hills. There seem to be many round puffs of smoke bursting there among the red roofs and soft cream walls, but I know they are almond or plum trees in full bloom. Beyond the shoulder of the more distant hill, there is the sea, blue and flat and glossy as a lady's luncheon cloth. Eleni has gone to sleep, and Margaret has walked down the mountain to Costa and the jeep. She evidently is still thinking of how she used to take her Ford apart and put it together again. I can only hope she won't try it with the jeep. A twig cracks near me. I jump. Three small boys have popped out of the ground to stare at me. Their clothes are in rags, and on their feet are handsome goatskin shoes as soft as bedroom slippers. Convinced that I haven't two heads and three tails, they wander off down the mountain. I wake Eleni. The afternoon is passing, and we are far from our destination. In fact, we are far from anywhere. The Jeep is finished. There's no passing traffic. And looming above everything else is the fact that we are in guerrilla territory. We will put our big brains together, Alini suggests. Perhaps we will stay the whole night here, or perhaps we will walk 4 hours back to Naupactos. We decide to coast down the mountain as far as we can go back towards Naupactos. We begin fairly slowly, but soon we are hurtling wildly around mountain curves. We can't slow up for anything. Boulders, gulches, ruts, ditches, washouts, bridges, sheep, donkeys, Greeks. If we once curb our speed, we will never make the next rise. Like people riding on a Coney Island, shoot the chute, we cling to our seats and scream. We coast 8 miles by the speedometer. When we stop, we are near a group of men and women working on a freshly plowed garden plot. They gather around the Jeep and begin to chatter excitedly. Weren't we afraid to go up into the gorilla country? Weren't we frightened for our very lives? Alini says we haven't enough sense to be frightened. They say they live in the little village of Efpalion, which we can see across flat green fields, tacked onto a steep hillside. Here, they are scared to death of the gorillas, they say. No one is allowed out of his house between 7 o'clock in the evening and 6 o'clock in the morning. Alini shakes her head and says again, it is like the days of the German occupation. An old man addresses Margaret and me, the Americans. He wishes the United States would help Greece get rid of the gorillas. The Greek army is too small to do it alone. We finally get around to our own plight. How are we going to get back to Naupactos or on to Delphi? Maybe the peasants suggest we can get animals from the village. We send Costa across the fields to inquire. The Greek men wander away. The women return to the small plot. There are two of them, a bright-eyed grandmother with a wrinkled face and no upper teeth, but a full row of tiny, crooked bottom ones, and a very pretty young woman with high coloring and two deep dimples in her cheeks. They are both in mourning from the black scarves they are wearing around their heads and across their chins to their brown, bare feet. They are planting onions and marrow. Idly, we stand on the side of the road and watch them. The old woman is spreading with her hands damp manure from a tall basket, and the young woman is poking the holes for the onion slips. I have an urge to get down and help the young woman, for I'm a great onion planter and eater, but unhappily I have lost my best black suit. I have on my best black suit. The manure gives out, and the old woman starts across the road to a nearby animal shelter, the basket on her shoulder. She stops close by us and confides that the young woman is her daughter-in-law and a widow, 24 years old. Her husband, the lady's only son, was captured by the guerrillas during one of their raids on the village, taken up into the hills, and so badly beaten that, though he escaped and made his way home, he died a few days later. Only 1 year had her son and daughter-in-law had together, she says, with tears in her small bright eyes. She continues across the road for the manure, and I stand staring at the young widow, wondering how she continues to so patiently planting onions in the bright sunlight. Feeling my eyes upon her, she looks up and smiles. Perhaps when you come again this way, the onions will be ready, she says. Perhaps they will be ready before we even get away, I answer, and gaily and musically she laughs, the dimples deepening in her cheeks. But it is no laughing matter, really. The sun is setting behind the hills, and we have no way to get to any town where we might safely spend the night. And then the miracle happens. A truck roars into view, the very first vehicle we have seen in 4 hours. Excitedly, we wave it down. It is a mysterious-looking truck, completely covered with tightly drawn canvas. The driver says he is taking olives to Athens and will tow us as far as Delphi. He is a surly fellow with a heavy growth of black beard, but this is no time to be squeamish. Alini, Margaret, and I once more heave and hove the Jeep about. The driver hitches it with a short rope to the back of the truck. We are ready to ride, but Costa has not returned. I stand on the side of the road and shout at the top of my lungs, Costa, Costa, Costa. The village looks as if it is a mile away, and I feel pretty silly yelling like that. But what can I do? The truck driver is restless. He wants to get moving. I scream some more. Margaret and Eleni join me. The once quiet countryside shakes with our shouts. But suppose Costa comes with animals. Will we have to go back to the village to return them? The driver grows more dour. At any moment, he is going to unhook us and proceed on his way. Look, Margaret cries. There comes Costa without animals. We sigh with relief. At top speed, Costa runs across the fields. Perspiration is cutting through the dust on his cheeks, and he breathes deeply. Get in quick, Costa. We're off to Delphi. And at that moment, as we're all settled, Eleni is inspired to ask the truck driver what time we will get to Delphi. Sometime after midnight, he says. We fall out of the jeep. Everyone has told us we must not travel over the gorillas' roads at night. It is madness to do so. The gorillas do not wait to ask questions at night. They shoot. The truck driver understands perfectly. He will tow us back to Naftpaktos. He unties the jeep and drives up the road to find a space wide enough to turn around. And we, for the third time that afternoon, shove the jeep about. The muscles in the back of my legs ache and my spine has queer twinges. Jostling toward Naftpaktos, Costa says we are very lucky, for he was unable to get animals. There were only communist animals in the town, he relates soberly, and the chief of police would not allow them to leave. What, I cry, no fascist, royalist animals? No, only communist. He shakes with laughter for a moment and then grows serious. The chief of police, he explains, would not let these animals out of town so late in the evening, for their owners would have to accompany them, and there was no telling what tragedy might happen. The communists would kill us just as likely as not, but even if they did not, the safety of the village would be endangered. After leaving us in Naftpaktos, the communists would go up into the hills and give the guerrillas information about the village's defenses. The chief of police said he simply could not take that chance. At Naftpaktos, the driver of the truck unties us. We sit in the middle of the main street, and dozens of men and women and children swarm around us as if we were animals in a cage. They even stick their heads into the jeep to see Margaret on the back seat more clearly. For their sakes, I'm sorry she looks so human. Eleni hops out to inquire if there is any chance of our returning that evening to our comfortable Cecil Hotel in Patras. Of course, it is on the east shore of the Gulf of Patras, and we are on the west, and the last ferry for the night has already left Antirion, which is a goodly number of miles away from Naftpaktos, but still Eleni will not give up. She returns with the news that she has hired a taxi to take us to Antirion. A wonderful taxi, she says, and in a few minutes a battered green touring car without windows or curtains and with mostly folds of bright pink cheesecloth for a top shows up. The make of it is a mystery for me, for I have seen nothing like it in my lifetime, but the driver insists it is a 1922 Ford. If it is, Mr. Ford should retire it and put it out to pasture. Nevertheless, it racks to Antirion at a breathtaking speed on the outer edge of the road, taking off only the loose splinters of the telephone post, but not any real heavy wood. At Antirion, Elena scurries about to find a fisherman to take us across the bay in a caique. It isn't difficult to find a fisherman, but the chief of police says it is against the law for a caique to leave the shore after sunset, and it is long after sunset. Eleni flashes her big black eyes. She smiles. She wheedles. Well, yes, this once the caique may go. The fisherman and his son rolled their pants above their knees and waded out into the sea to bring the Kaikui closer to shore. It is a good-sized boat, at least 20 feet long, and stands high out of the water. The fisherman runs a narrow plank from the shore to the bow for us to teeter to. It is almost perpendicular, and I am confident it will topple off into the water. But somehow, I make it, and so do Eleni and Margaret. Quickly and skillfully, the fisherman and his son unwrap the great white sail and hoist it to the top of the mast. The wind catches it instantly and billows it out like the stomach of a giant clown. The sharp, curving bow cuts cleanly through the water, turning up beneath the surface fresh furrows of green edged with white. Spray dashes lightly against our cheeks, our lips, our eyes. We laugh from sheer exuberance. And as if this sensation of sailing with abandon out to sea isn't enough enjoyment for one evening, the moon comes up suddenly from behind a fold of purple mountains on the mainland and hangs round in gold as a new locket in the luminous sky. We must sail all night, we impulsively decide. We must not dock until the moon docks, whatever hour that may be. How about sailing us to Athens? We call to the fisherman. He grins broadly and shrugs his shoulders. We mean it, we insist, forgetting entirely about the blocked Corinth Canal. Take us to Piraeus. But before we know it, we are standing off the beach of Rion with our luggage piled around us, and our lovely, lovely ship is sailing back across the moonbrush sea. Well, what to do now? We wonder rather casually. We're alone on the beach, and the town of Rion is a mile or two away, but none of that seems important. The night is too heavenly to worry about mundane things. Lightheartedly, we pick up our coats and bags and start across the wide stretch of sand. Halfway across, two men, the ticket seller and the baggage porter for the ferry, meet us. They are horrified to see us. There are no buses, no taxis, no trucks for Patras this time of night. Maybe, if we walk to Rion, we can catch a train. Intoxie, we say. But before starting out on the long walk, we must stop in the ticket seller's tiny unpainted shack, lighted uncertainly by a carbon lamp, and have some refreshments. What will we have? The ticket seller asks. A sweet and a glass of water or wine? A sweet and a glass of water, I say. The sweet is a small dab of preserves in a white saucer. Eleni is delighted. It is a Greek custom, she exults. Everywhere you go in Greece and Turkey, people will serve you a sweet and a glass of water as soon as you arrive. And now, by coincidence, you see it for yourself. It is a custom I could have done very well without, I think to myself, spooning up the preserves. But, of course, my manners are too good to allow me to say so. When we finish, we set out again. We walk in the middle of a sandy, rutty road, Eleni, Margaret, and I carrying our heavy coats, lunch basket, nap cases, and other odds and ends, and the two men carrying our suitcases. The night is as light as day, but with that soft, peach bloomy look that a day never has. Rion is a small fishing village, and when we arrive, all the male fishermen are standing, talking in front of one taverna. They gather closely about us to know what kind of creatures we are and whither are we going. Nowhere immediately it develops. The train for Patras will not come until around 9 o'clock. In the meantime, we will go to the taverna and have a little retzina. The idea is a natural. Everybody accompanies us into the taverna. The fisherman, the chief of police, the ticket seller, the baggage porter, everybody. We sit at small tables, and the policeman and porter sitting with us. They say, "Ya su," which are the words the Greeks have for your good health. Or, "Here's to you." I say, "Yasu." It comes easily to my Georgia tongue. In the front end of the taverna is a barber shop, in the back, a butcher shop. A whole skinned lamb, head to tail, hangs from a rafter, and the butcher punctuates our gay cries of Yasu by slamming his cleaver on the backbone of some other unfortunate animal. With a second round of Retsina, the porter dashes out of the taverna to return a few minutes later with an armful of almond blossoms. Bowing deeply, he presents them to me. Yasu, I say. At this moment, the train is reported on its way. We go forth, accompanied, as we have entered, by the entire male population. The train might be on its way, but it is still not in sight. We walk up and down the track in the full, soft moonlight. Greek-American relations, I feel, are very close. And then suddenly the porter gestures to me to step to one side. Remembering the autumn blossoms, I do not know whether this is discreet or not, but never one to worry overly about deception. Discretion, I step. He beckons to a male friend to join us. The friend can speak English, and he says the porter does not feel that Alini has given him a large enough tip for bringing the baggage. I am crushed. All seemed so beautiful a minute before, and now money, the root of all evil, has reared its ugly head. I hurry to Alini. My God, she cries, pay no attention to him. I know my countryman. If you give him more money, he will be offensed. The little train rolls in. We climb onto the platform but can get no further. Men, women, children, babies, and chickens are hanging out of the doors and windows. I cling to a door handle and rock on the platform. The flat fields near the track are a bridal veil wide, and far off on the horizon, the snow-capped mountaintops have a shine on them like satin slippers. Even tired as I am sorry that when we come to Patras, I would have gladly ridden all night through that misty, warm moonlight of Greece. Of chapter 11.